So my favorite part, though, in Harry Potter.
Yes, Flood, tell me.
My favorite part is when Gary Oldman, who's sexy as hell.
According to you.
Yeah, Gary Oldman is a sexy man. I think.
I can't see it.
I think if we get emails from our hopefully our female listeners.
Right, Phil at From the Heart of Hollywood.
No, I can't check my emails.
Dean at From the Heart of Hollywood.com.
Or visit us on MySpace.
MySpace.
At From the Heart of Hollywood. MySpace.com/ From the Heart of Hollywood, right?
Right, yeah.
And, you know, or visit either of us on MySpace, but drop us a line and let us know whether you think Gary Oldman is sexy. Because I maintain that women think Gary Oldman is sexy. Well, I think Gary Oldman is sexy. He's one of the sexiest mofos out there.
Because he's so emotional and soulful. It's
and powerful. He's powerful.
Powerful.
And he's wiry. And he's got a darkness and an edge. And anyway,
you're
so
making me
sexy,
feel uncomfortable.
So sexy when he, my favorite part of the movie, the nefarious and evil henchman of the Dark Lord, Lucius Malfoy, has his grasp on Harry Potter and his godfather, Sirius Black, the rumored mass murderer, who's actually a loving, doting godfather, mm-hmm. who can turn into an adorable dog named Padfoot. He shows up looking
alert.
Very sexy.
Yep.
Get your hands off my godson. And instead of, and he's so enraged, and it's so personal now, that instead of pulling out a wand or using magic or witchcraft or wizardry, he balls up his fists and he decks the guy.
Wow.
And it felt so good to see that. Because as a godfather who dotes on his goddaughter, anybody lays their hands on her, I'm throwing fists first, I'm asking questions, and grabbing my wand second.
Well, I hope not in that order, really. But
because, as you know,
yes,
I'm a violence prevention specialist, and I'm dead set against the use of violence. That doesn't mean I'm not extraordinarily good at it, and if you threaten my goddaughter, I'm going to be on you.
Wait a sec. That seems a contradiction within yourself.
Well,
you're that complex a character?
I would beg to differ. So, true Potter enough. 5, yeah.
Potter 5, you're in.
What, did you see anything while you were traveling?
Well, no. Well, that's not true. On the plane, Last Mimsy and Blades of Glory. Saw those two again.
Oh, again, yeah.
Yeah, because I've seen them both.
I never saw The Last Mimsy.
It's pathetic.
Is it really going to be the last one?
Yeah, I hope so.
No, what was the first Mimsy?
There was 1,000 Mimsies.
Oh.
Mimsies were these computer-operated rabbits that were sent out through time in order to collect the tears of a child, you know, for the purity of the DNA, so that the species who created these Mimsies could then save themselves from their own extinction by grabbing the DNA of some strange child from some future past world and carry on their species.
And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chillpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Larenas.
Hi, everybody. This is Phil Larenas, and this is your Chillpack Hollywood Hour. And coming at you from Motown after a long weekend of stripping the paint off the deck.
That's the thing. It wasn't a long weekend.
I need
more hours in the weekend to do a deck. Holy crap.
The Motor City Madman.
Hi, everyone.
Dean Haglund.
I'm covered in sawdust.
Oh my god, 12 years from now that might be the clip that we choose. at the outset of the show, we had a cold open, as they say in the biz, and that was a clip from your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, back when it was known as From the Heart of Hollywood 12 years ago this week, and we were talking about the sex appeal of Gary Oldman and Dean's hatred of The Last Mimsy, a movie he had seen more than once.
That was the biggest shock to me. I went, why did I watch that more than once? I hated it the first time. Why would I pick it again on a flight? I can't remember the flight. I can't remember what would have brought me to watch that. And I had forgotten the plot till I heard myself quickly sum up the plot in an elevator pitch. How did that movie ever get made? That's the thing. Okay, we're collecting children's tears for the DNA of another species. What? No, get out of the room, sir.
Oh, come on now. That is exactly what's going on in the detention facilities at the border. Right now.
Right now? That is our ICE manifesto?
Oh, my God. I so want to drop in ICE baby right now, but I'm not going to do it. Look, this is the first week I feel where what we talked about either isn't relevant to anything today, or maybe even outright a bad look historically for us in the few weeks that we've been doing this. Because like last week, to remind, the segment of Futures Past featured a clip where we discussed your trip to Roswell, your very first trip to Roswell, right?
Right.
And no sooner do we discuss that than this Facebook plan, a Facebook-based plan to break into Area 51.
Right.
Just breaks huge, right? Like 500,000 people are planning on breaking into Area 51, storming the castle on September 20th.
And again, to say storming the castle, perhaps people don't know that the actual perimeter of Area 51 is like a good 30 miles. So for 500,000 people to run 30 miles to get to the actual base from the perimeter, let's just say that's a marathon that is going to be the saddest marathon I've ever seen. In the summer, again, why are we doing it in the summer in Nevada? If you're going to do it anytime, bloody hell, the shortest day of the year, December 21st, the sun goes down at 5. Now you got the cover of darkness. Now it's nice and cool. There I could see 500,000 people running a marathon for 30 miles. July 20th, I'm going to say the sun, it'll be 95 degrees. The sun's going to be up till about 10 p.m. And you are going to get as far as the old sign that said we use lethal force beyond this force sign. And that sign has been pushed back 2 miles. So below the ridge, because it used to be you get up a ridge and you can have a telephoto lens and see it.
Oh, well, remember Tucker Smallwood in our film The Truth Is Out There talks about back in the days when you used to be able to go camping and hunting all around there, and what he and his old Air Force and Army buddies witnessed when they were up on the ridge. And so definitely people should check that out. I mean, the geography, the calendar aside, I hate to be a buzzkill, but I'm not entirely sure that there is a legitimate cause for anyone to make a bum rush into a top secret military installation, especially because one needs to consider that alien or experimental spacecraft aside, there are also a lot of secret operations that come out of Area 51, not the least of which was SEAL Team 6's operation that went over and got bin Laden.
So, exactly.
So we have many personnel whose very identity needs to be maintained, an anonymous distinction when it comes to military service. Otherwise, right, you are risking their lives. And I don't think the plan is, unless I'm mistaken, to storm Area 51, but not to take any pictures or video. No, I think the plan is to actually... And so just think of all the things. I mean, if we accept that for security purposes... There are, I would be the first to argue that there should always be greater transparency, that so many of the things that are kept secret should not be kept secret, that secrecy destroys, and at the same time, there are brave men and women who do put their lives on the line on our behalf, and right, when their identities get revealed, their lives are in peril, even more than they ordinarily are.
Right.
So anyway, so maybe there's a better idea than 500,000 people bum rushing only to find out that they don't have what it takes for a 30-mile hike.
Well, you know, and this comes back to a comedian's joke going, I like that we have robots that vacuum, machines that wash our dishes and laundry, and now we have all the time in the world to go backwards into arguments that were resolved hundreds of years ago. Galileo and Flat Earth, Area 51, what's going on there? Like, all of these things are just a fact that we just got too much bloody time on our hands. Hey, man, go redo your deck. Don't hire someone. Do it yourself. See how much time you got to go storm Area 51 when you're sanding and pressure washing 200 square feet of wood.
Well, two things that would come up from me, right, when we would have these Q&As, and you're almost echoing them now, right. But when we would have Q&As about the truth is out there, and people would press us sometimes on trying to get us to say what we believe, right?
Right.
Even though I tend to find that I believe is not very interesting. I'm much more interested in what people know, right? But... I would say that for all the people who are desperate to know what's going on at Area 51, if I were to know exactly what's at Area 51, even if it was alien aircraft, my life wouldn't change one damn bit. I still have the exact same responsibilities that I have before, and I don't have enough time to attend to those responsibilities and to train for a 30-mile sprint from the perimeter into Area 51. That's how I feel.
I don't rather use lethal force. How fast can you outrun a bullet energy?
Well, they've got that kind of sprinting that they're planning to do from
the Ruto.
Exactly. Arms behind you. And, may I suggest, serpentine, like in The In-Laws. So you're right. You're right. We've created enough time. We're all so busy, and yet we have enough time to argue these things that should have been long since settled. Meanwhile, however, you and I will occasionally apparently play a clip that is baffling based on who we once were. You deciding to see movies that you hate more than once so that you can hate them even more. And you me... know. Regaling the audience with the sex appeal of a known abuser.
Hello from Harry Potter 5, no less.
I mean, look, I understand I was wrapped up in Harry Potter fever, and I guess in fairness to myself, even though I was a state-certified violence prevention specialist back then, I did not know of Gary Oldman's questionable history when it came to violence and women. So I am not saying that Gary Oldman should not ever be hired. I'm not saying that. I am just saying it's a bad look. And no, I don't find that person particularly attractive. Might I find characters that he plays interesting or attractive? Maybe so. But Gary Oldman, no. It's a bad look. Yeah.
Very good.
It's a bad look.
Situation solved.
And now I can see it more clearly because I do have one working eye. And we have a surgical date for the second eye, July 24th, Dean. It's all coming together on July 24th.
And how fast is the first one healing is my question.
I don't know. I have nothing to compare it to, really. Well, but they seem... They seem pleased by it. They've slowed down the medications on it, and but I did witness really firsthand the importance of the medication they're giving me when I was kind of freaking out when I went out earlier, and I was going, okay, there's been a major step back in the eye, in the vision in my surgically repaired eye. And I'm not seeing as far, I'm not seeing as clear, and maybe I'm tired. And no, it was just the eye was getting dried out. And so, you know, I'm not producing tears normally. And anyway, so that's why I need the good laugh from the last Mimsy in order to produce the tears.
Oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you, last Mimsy has no laughs in it.
Well, and yet they're collecting all the tears that I need, apparently.
Yeah.
See, where are we going with that? Hey, talk to me about live comedy. I believe you did a live comedy show this week, and I believe you have a live comedy show coming up. What?
That is correct.
Okay, talk to me.
Very good. So there is a hilarious, if you've ever seen Setlist is a show around the world where stand-up comedians get up on stage and their list of jokes is projected on a screen that they've never seen before. And basically it's a couple words and they have to then build a stand-up bit around the words that are on the screen. If you've ever seen, I think they show it on Comedy Central, perhaps. Setlist is a format loved by comedians and audiences alike. So here in Detroit, a couple guys who are into conspiracy theories have taken that one step further, and they have comedians and improvisers come up as characters who are conspiracy theorists or researchers, and then they're shown not just words but a series of bizarre photos that may or may not be pertaining to their conspiracy, that they then have to improvise a monologue of that conspiracy. So the show is called Truth, T-R-U-T-H, with periods after all of them, The Real Heroes of Untold. So I did that. I was a character. I was a 90s DJ who quit because of the Illuminati, and then basically for 10 minutes sort of wrapped up the entire conspiracy historically and exponentially, and big laughs all around at the Go Comedy Theater at Ferndale at 9 Mile Road and Woodward.
And will you be doing it again?
No, on July 25th, I'll be dusting off the old X-Files improv, the one man X-Files improvisation that I've done at conventions and comedy clubs and in the West End and on Broadway, I guess, technically, and in Los Angeles. I'll be doing that show for the first time here in Detroit, July 25th. Get your tickets at gocomedy.com.
Is it the same venue? Where is it? Where is the venue for this?
Same venue, Nine Mile Road and Woodward Avenue.
Excellent. Well, we will link to that ticket site in the description for this show over at chillpackhollywood.com and on Blog Talk Radio. And we'll make that the live event of the week.
Yay!
The Chill Pack Hollywood live event of the week.
Right off of a live event of the week, what could be less appropriate than to step inside the Chill Pack morgue for a quick round of celebrity deaths?
Celebrity deaths.
At 89 years of age, Ross Perot died.
Oh,
Dean Hackman.
I missed this story.
Did you really? How fascinating.
I am fascinated. I did not hear this at all.
So a self-made billionaire businessman.
Oil guy?
No, he was not. How interesting that you would think that. No, he was self-made. He ran as an independent for president in 92 and 96. He founded Electronic Data Systems in 1962, a data processing firm that quickly grew, made him rich. He went on to found the IT provider Perot Systems and to become an angel investor in Steve Jobs' Next Inc. Before he threw his hat into the political ring.
Right.
His 92 presidential campaign was one of the most successful independent runs of the 20th century, winning nearly 20% of the popular vote. And quite honestly, he would have won a lot more, but he dropped out during the summer only to get back in. But there, there was a time when he was actually leading in the polls.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What he was saying made sense, that he was independent, that
he was the only one that was arguing about the danger of these increased and never-ending deficits.
Yeah,
and
right.
He was famous because he was easily imitated, and he was famous for dropping out really colorful catchphrases like that sucking sound you hear is NAFTA taking away all our jobs to Mexico, right? And and so, you know, really, as has been said, there is no Donald Trump running for president without Ross Perot. But the lesson learned was, although he ran as an independent and then, as the 96 election approached, founds the Reform Party, which would attract other notable political candidates through the years, including Pat Buchanan, Ralph Nader, Jesse Ventura. The lesson that was learned was, instead of trying to be an outsider and change the system from the outside, it's better to take control of a political party and change that party to fit your own view of how the system needs to change, a la what Trump has done. There's other significant differences as well, obviously. Perot, as I mentioned, actually was worth a fortune instead of claiming to be worth a fortune. He did build an empire. He actually built stuff. And he did have ideas. He also did not, as far as I know, blow racial dog whistles. So there were some significant differences. But it is safe to say that that kind of independent populism, that kind of dissatisfaction with the binary system, really does set the playing field for where we find ourselves less than a few decades later.
I know, right? It was the beginning, the ripple in the pond. If you ever thought, can one person make a difference? There is an example right there. Ross Perot, one person making a difference. Who can predict what that difference will be? Because it's a big ocean.
Today, I don't know if you saw, this weekend, our president tweeted at several congresswomen of color, saying that they should go back to their own countries, go back to their countries of origin before trying to tell us how to run things here.
Aren't they all American? Pardon?
Well, the three of the four were born in this country. Yeah, going back to their own countries would involve going back to, I think, Cincinnati, maybe Detroit and New York. So anyway, and of course we know he doesn't think Puerto Rico is part of this country either. So there's that. But the whole point is, regardless of where they're from, they're American citizens. So it is just it's race. The fact that they're of color is race baiting. It's the worst kind of nationalism. You know, it's the kind of dog shit that you hope will really stick to his shoe. Because I continue, as you know, not to criticize people who voted for Trump. I know a lot of people that voted for Trump. I'm not critical of their vote. I'm critical of him. And how his knee jerk is antithetical to everything we argue about in The Truth Is Out There, right? Anyone who disagrees with him is to be cut out in the most vile terms imaginable. And we're sitting over here going, you know, everyone should be listened to, even and maybe even especially the people who supported him. And
a view that we may disagree with, in The Truth Is Out There, we still give them their time. And listen, and don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, as we said.
And not even disagree with them. I mean, we're trying to get above and beyond that to the point where we can learn something of interest and value from them. from people that we might disagree with. And I'm proud to say that as I continue to work slowly, as the recovery on my eyes takes place, but as I continue to work with forming The Truth Is Out There too, that is still very much at the heart of it. Now, this time, I guess we do offer some healthier suggestions than what is often rather militantly and rigidly being thrust forward as opinion. You know, the film takes some time to offer maybe some different ways to look at things, but not to cut people out, not to make people feel unseen and unheard. So, anyway, Ross Perot, 89 years of age.
Fascinating.
Now, here's a name that I bet you will not know off the top of your head, Dean. Jim Boughton died at 80 years of age.
Jim Boughton, that's a tough one. Who's Jim Boughton?
Former Yankee all-star pitchers probably would not make celebrity deaths on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. However, when that former all-star pitcher wrote the first insider's expose of what life in Major League Baseball was like, then they do. And Ball 4 was published in 1970 and is considered one of the most important sports books of all time. Boughton gave readers the first inside look at the game and the players and the seedier side of professional sports. Before his book, baseball players especially had a very wholesome image, all-American image. And he shattered that image, revealing the truth behind the game. And as a result, he was ostracized by many players and apparently was blacklisted by the league. At his peak, he was a hard-throwing fastball pitcher with the Yankees, won 40 games in 62 and 63. After he retired, also a reason he makes it into celebrity deaths, he became an actor. And starred in one of my all-time favorite films, Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye.
And
he starred in a sitcom version of his book, Ball 4, that was sadly canceled after 5 episodes. I wish I could know what the audience numbers were back then, because you'd probably look at it and go, there's only 25 million people a week watching it. Yeah, we got to cancel this.
Nobody's watching that, 25 million. That's so sad. So it's called Ball 4. Ball 4 was the sitcom?
Yeah, based on the book Ball 4. And, you know, and I mentioned that because last week we discussed television shows. What are really good approaches for making great shows? And it occurred to me that, what is entirely possible now, given the shorter seasons and given often the irregular launch dates and the year-long calendar for shows on all networks and outlets, is that the traditional UK approach of not having seasons so much as having series would be the way to go. That you bring back a set of characters if you have a new series idea. What might be going on in their lives that is worthy of another series? You know, it was one of my favorite stories about one of, you know, my beloved shows, as you know. But when Remington Steele made Pierce Brosnan a star, fresh to America, at the end of the first season, when they excitedly announced that they'd been picked up for a second season, Pierce Brosnan excitedly said, "Great, what's the show going to be next year?" And they said, "Well, it's going to be just like this one. It's going to be the same thing." And he went, "No, what? Really? What's the show going to be next year?" He didn't understand that in America, they do the same thing year after year after year.
That's true. That is true.
So that's how you come out of character, and that's why you take time. It's like what Larry David does, right, with Curb Your Enthusiasm. He takes as much time off as he needs until it occurs to him, I bet this is going on in my character's life right now. This is worthy of exploration.
Right? Yeah. And then he takes the time. And HBO, bless their hearts, has the capacity and the breadth and the financial strength to store, to weather out waiting for Larry David to come up with that thing. I know so much in network TV was this exacerbation by the suits, quote unquote, that were always in constant fear that the creators would dry up or not have an idea or not go next season. And it was this ongoing stress amongst everybody in network that show, you know, where's the next idea coming from? Are the next generation of kids going to develop scripts? Good Lord, is our careers intact? That's the morning. That's the stress they woke up with in the morning and the stress they drove home with at night.
You know, when we were talking about great finales, right, and how few there really have been, one that we overlooked was, and it's astonishing that I overlooked it, and no sooner did the show go up than this sad news reminded me of a great finale, but the Larry Sanders Show finale.
Oh, my God.
Could not have been more perfect. It was exactly where it needed to end, with a late night show host retiring with no future plans.
Yeah, right.
And one of the stars, of course, of that long running, groundbreaking Emmy winning show was, for my money, one of the greatest character actors of all time, Rip Torn.
Yes.
And he died this week at the age of 88.
No, isn't that shocking?
No, not shocking. I mean, I guess, what are you saying? That he lived that long? That he wasn't dead already? I mean, this is a man who at 79 got arrested for armed robbery of a bank.
Oh, right. I forgot that story.
Although he wasn't charged with armed robbery, with bank robbery. He was charged with being armed and breaking into a bank that he apparently thought was his house.
Well, you know, he had very modern architectural tastes. So,
but you know, what was kind of great about it, and who knows what kind of confusion was going on there that led to it, but there are so many great stories about Rip Torn.
So many.
First of all, the performances from Artie on The Larry Sanders Show, which is one of the all-time great characters, right, on TV.
Yeah.
To Chief Zed in the Men in Black movies, right?
Yeah.
His career spans more than 50 years. He begins in the 1950s with small movie roles, with TV roles on anthology shows like Alfred Hitchcock Presents. He appeared on Broadway in plays like Sweet Bird of Youth, for which he receives a Tony nomination. He makes his real big mark in dramatic films of the 60s and 70s with such films as The Cincinnati Kid and The Man Who Fell to Earth. He was Oscar nominated for Cross Creek. Suffered a bit of a career slump in the 1980s, but then Larry Sanders relaunches him. And, you know, and then he does so many supporting films, especially now that people go, oh, my God, Rip Torn's funny. And so he's doing, you know, Disney animated films. He's appearing in Albert Brooks' Defending Your Life. He's in Dodgeball. And he's playing a recurring role on 30 Rock. And I love him, of course, in one of the most underrated gems, Wonder Boys, where he and Michael Douglas and Robert Downey Jr. are all doing some of the best work they've ever done. So just a wonderful filmography he leaves behind. In addition to, oh, by the way, one of the greatest TV roles of all time.
All right. Yeah, Larry Sanders, good Lord, that show. And shockingly, the lowest rated HBO show, but how influential it was for so many generations that's a touchstone on, you know, you wouldn't have The Office. You wouldn't have all the reality shows that has the camera as a third character sort of thing.
So we started with him breaking into a bank he thought was his house. So I'm going to offer up three quick Rip Torn stories for your enjoyment.
Okay.
Because he was always known for his temper, and I've got so many. I mean, my friend Linda Geringer, who Lily has appeared with on stage, played a love interest of Rip Torn's on The Larry Sanders Show. And when a director tried to direct a kissing scene that they had, oh my God, the way he went just over the top. I mean, it blew his stack. Because he was so outraged that anyone would think they needed to teach him how to kiss a beautiful woman. But he was known for his temper, and he acknowledged it. And one of his most memorable fights actually broke out while the camera was rolling and gets immortalized on screen. And it was when he was improvising a scene with Norman Mailer, who was directing and acting in the movie Maidstone. And they were improvising a scene, and they got into a physical fight that ends up on screen. And during the scene, Rip Torn hits him in the head with a hammer.
No.
Yeah. And Mailer retaliates by biting his ear.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I have not seen this.
And you can. It's on screen. Another story that is famous and famously wrong. Dennis Hopper repeatedly told the story of Rip Torn pulling a knife on him on the set of Easy Rider. And that for that reason, Rip Torn was fired and replaced with an unknown Jack Nicholson. Okay?
Right.
And history is made. But Torn vehemently always denied that version of the events, saying that it was Dennis Hopper who pulled the knife on him.
Yeah, I can see that.
Torn eventually sued Hopper after Hopper told the story his own way on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and Rip Torn won the lawsuit.
Ah, fantastic.
Yeah.
Advocated.
So, vindicated, you mean.
Vindicated. Yeah, not
abdicated. Not abdicated. Yeah. He was the king of character actors. He did not abdicate that throne.
He's vindicated. Fantastic. How much did he get, money or just a retraction?
I don't know. But I love this quote from him. He said, "I used to get hurt when I was falsely accused of making trouble. I may be an actor, but I'm still a human being. So I just don't give people trouble anymore. I say to them, excuse me, I only fight with friends, and I walk away."
That's fantastic.
Yeah, because you've insulted the person wonderfully by saying they're not your friend, and you said you only fight with friends, and I love that. I mean, I feel like, again, that is where we need to get back to, that we ought to hold our friends more accountable. We ought to hold feet to the fire of those people that we love the most. And
stop taking pot shots at strangers online.
Exactly.
I agree.
All right. Finally, let's close up the Chill Pack Morgue with Valentina Cortesi. She was 96, a legend of cinema in her native Italy. She gained international acclaim in Italian films in the 40s, which led to her signing a contract with 20th Century Fox in the 1950s. She starred with American actor Richard Basehart in The House on Telegraph Hill. They fell in love. They got married. Decades later, she would be nominated for a Best Supporting Actress Oscar in 75 for Truffaut's Day for Night.
Cool.
She would lose to Ingrid Bergman, who won for Murder on the Orient Express. And in accepting the Oscar that year, Ingrid Bergman said up on stage that Valentina gave the most beautiful performance. "Please forgive me, Valentina." That's what she said when she accepted the award. She appeared in films directed by Fellini, by Michelangelo Antonioni, not only a movie star, but a fashion icon, one of the like that we will never see again. And I guess, since I'm rushing through this, we have time for just one more. Dead at 62 years of age, Dean, following a stroke that led to her being on life support. Again, really young, it seems, for that to happen. Denise Nickerson, the former child actress who is best known for playing Violet Beauregard, most famous for playing Violet Beauregard, the gum chewer who turns into a blueberry in the 1971 movie Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, right. Yes. The one who, she illegally ate the blueberry gum and enlarged. So she had a stroke, you say?
Yeah, had a stroke at 62 and was hospitalized and then put on life support and went into a coma. It's an all too common refrain in celebrity deaths on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
No. It's becoming a thing where we might have to point out this statistic anomaly to the FDA.
she had a quote when much of the cast of Willy Wonka reunited for an appearance on the Today Show in 2015. And I thought you might really like this. This actually made me think of you. Because she said, we are the fortunate ones. We're here. We got, meaning us, the cast of the Willy Wonka, we got to really see it and experience it. And the first thing people do when they find out who we are is they smile. And so she was so grateful for that experience. And I think about that with you, that, you know, that's very much how you are with the people that who meet you. And especially these days, ever since you cut your hair for Spectres, right?
Yeah.
That it often takes a moment. And then when people realize who you are, they break into these huge grins.
That's true.
That's kind of a cool way to get to walk through the world, Dean Haglund.
Fantastic. And I think about my fellow actors who played bad guys or meanies or assassins and people who have confused the character for the actor and how hard it must be for them. Watching Laffin in the and seeing Miss Carney get water thrown at her as the Sakatumi time. She's the Sakatumi girl. How many restaurants did she walk into in Los Angeles and somebody throw a glass of water at her screaming Sakatumi? I can't imagine what she went through being on a comedy show, no less. So I am grateful beyond belief that a smile breaks out anytime someone learns my character.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. It's pretty neat. Yeah. And to be able to know that you were there, to, like she said, to witness something getting made to get to see behind the curtain.
I'd see all the talent. Good Lord.
Yeah, Kim, all the talent.
Yeah. I mean, Kim Manners, it's over a decade since he passed away from lung cancer, but I still think about his directing style and his catchphrases and his motivational techniques and what a brilliant director that guy was.
The everybody, I mean, the camera crews, the production design, the writers, that writer's room. I mean, anyway, I thought of you. I want to move into movies a bit, and I promised to share with you a change.org petition about the landmark and historic Egyptian Theater here in Hollywood and what's going on with that.
Netflix trying to buy it, try to squeeze out the last of the film independence.
Well, the Egyptian Theater, for those who don't know, this is one of the great Sid Grauman theaters just down the street.
One of the first red carpets before the Chinese theater.
Wonderful theater. And today, much better equipped, honestly, than the Chinese theater itself. And it's home to the American Cinematheque, a membership-based nonprofit organization celebrating the art and history and cultural legacy of cinema. It operates the landmark Egyptian Theater there on Hollywood Boulevard, and the building itself was gifted to the Cinematheque by the city of Los Angeles for the symbolic price of $1.
Right, because before then, homeless people were sleeping in there, pigeons were in the rafters, This was a historic architectural legacy piece that was in ruined. I remember being there in 97, seeing it in disrepair and just jaw dropping in how something so gorgeous can be left to such a state. So absolutely, the city gives it for a dollar to somebody who's going to maintain it.
So the Cinematheque has held the theater in the public trust, as I understand it. And the Cinematheque itself is currently operating without an executive director and with its charitable status currently listed as delinquent due to incomplete tax filings dating back to 2015. Okay. The Cinematheque's board of directors has apparently offered the theater for sale to Netflix, which happens to be the employer of board member Ted Sarandos. Ted Sarandos being the bigwig, the chief officer of Netflix and a board member of Cinematheque.
Problematic.
The California Attorney General is currently investigating the Cinematheque for its failure to file the required financial information. Its claim to have lost this information due to staff incompetence, illness, and to computer problems, as well as investigating two unexplained outstanding loans to board members.
Oh, embezzlement.
So, in light of the ongoing financial mismanagement by the American Cinematheque Board, resulting in potential loss of both its nonprofit status, its failure to hire a new executive director, as well as the conflict of interest that seems apparent, and not just potential, between board member Ted Sarandos and Netflix purchasing the theater, as well as the failure to inform members that a financial crisis might require a sale of the theater in the first place and threaten the very existence of the nonprofit, which they have utterly failed to do, the undersigned of the petition are calling for a halt to any sale and for a public meeting at the Egyptian Theater where representatives of the nonprofit will explain the situation, take and respond to questions, and engage in a free, open, and transparent dialogue moving forward about the future of the treasured membership-based nonprofit, as well as its sole asset, the Egyptian Theater. The future of the American Cinematheque and the Egyptian Theater should be determined in an open conversation that includes the members and a qualified executive director and not in secret by the board of directors of the Cinematheque and Netflix. So ends the petition, which I gladly, proudly signed on change.org.
Very good. Send me the link. And also, send me a link to the application to be the fucking executive director. I will run that thing, for crying out loud. I know administration. I know how to talk to board members. My 4 years in Australia running comedy clubs and asked to be the artistic director of Impro Australia. These are all.
I love that. What are your qualifications to run a nonprofit? I was asked to be the head of an art company. What?
I was given the job and I was leaving the country at the same time. So,
what is your qualification to do this job, sir? Well, I've turned down better jobs.
Exactly. So right there. Oh my God. How hard can it be? All I have to do is fill out the tax forms from 2015, not be negligent, and just say, this is a conflict of interest, you jerk. And we're going to keep this and we're going to maintain this to the integrity of how it was given to us for a dollar in the first place. We are America's Cinematheque. We are the vanguards of the art and culture of film. We are not Netflix. We're not a subscriber buying $4-8 billion worth of gunk and throwing it on the screen every 4 days, some new series. We are better than that. So, I don't know. I don't know.
Wow, Dean Haglund with a soapbox, ladies and gentlemen.
There you go. Send that. Dude, just take that clip and email it to them, and I'll take the job.
Done and done. But first, you'll sign the petition.
Yes. Yes. First, I'm signing the petition. Second, I'm doing something about it. I just sanded and pressure washed a deck. I could run American Cinema Tech.
You'd have to come back here, though. You do know that.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, I could fly in for the weekend meetings.
They only have programming, I think, Thursday nights through Sunday. So, you know.
Well, I don't have to. I can program from a distance.
You can be bi-coastal, assuming that Lake Michigan is a coast.
Yes. Well, Lake St. Clair is a coast. That's the closest lake to me.
Lake St. Clair is also the name of my favorite paint stripper. All right. That's kind of a callback to a conversation we had before the show began.
Yeah,
all right.
That's good. So
I want to talk about a few movies. We've got so many movie topics backlogged. But, you know, I caught up with, for the first time since film school, a film that I think is much more interesting than I gave it credit for when I first saw it. And that is Alfred Hitchcock's Rope.
Ah, yes. This is something we've been meaning to talk about for a few weeks now.
Yeah. Are you?
I actually really love Rope.
Okay.
And not just for its unique cinematography and that it was a stage play, apparently, that's then transformed into a movie, but that also Alfred Hitchcock himself designed the camera needed for those long takes.
Okay.
Up until that time.
So that's what, so the people know, this is why it was so famous, and this is what gets shoved down your throat, is that it's 80 minutes, and it's supposedly, you know, 8-10-minute takes that are with kind of seamless or trying to be seamless transitions. The Birdman of its age, let's say.
Yeah,
and, you know, with invisible transitions. So that's the idea. And yes, based on a stage play. What's delicious, if you're a Hitchcock fan, is it's his first film in Hollywood free of the contract with David O. Selznick.
Right.
And so, you know, it begins with a couple people strangling to death and shoving someone named David into a box.
Right.
And so Hitchcock was free, and he was free to experiment. And that's what he does.
Yes.
And, you know, it's interesting because now revisiting this decades later, I realize that what is best about it only peripherally has to do with the long master takes. And the weaknesses are all because of the long master takes.
Exactly, right? You see it now, and if there's some, I don't want to say clumsy staging, but theatrical staging, like staging that seems to be lifted directly from the Broadway show.
Well, here's the thing is it's about how it's arbitrary. His forcing his style upon this was all about, I want to make it seem like it could be one long take, although there is a cut to a reaction in the film. So there is actually one cut anyway that is obviously cutting to a reaction shot. But beyond that, even if that weren't the case, because he wanted it to seem all the other times like it was one seamless take where the camera, you know, goes past the back of somebody and that's when we've seamlessly made the cut. And then when we continue panning past them, we're now on to a new roll of film. But it seems like it's still a continued take. But here's the problem. The play does not unfold in real time. It still compresses time. It's one evening, one night, and one aftermath of that party. It's not 80 minutes. It's 6 hours compressed into 80 minutes. And so when time passes, while you're watching in a master shot without a cut, that's really jarring and disjointed.
You know, I forgot that. That is exactly, there's the aftermath at the end, the third act, basically.
And there's the first part, which is the death takes place before anyone arrives. And,
yes.
I mean, halfway through the film, everyone's four sheets to the wind. They've all been drinking so much. They've killed somebody. They've set up for a party. They've welcomed all the guests. They've drank all their cocktails. They've eaten all their dinner in an hour. And it's nighttime now. And so a far better approach would have been to every time you go in for one of those quote-unquote blackouts on somebody's back, when you come away, surprise us by changing the lighting and changing the mise-en-scene so that we go, oh, time has passed.
Ah, that's a smarter move, isn't it?
Because what is great about the master shots is it recreates the sense of suspense that the stage production held, which is what people are doing while other people might be unaware that they're doing it.
Exactly. So now, you know what? I'm going to watch it again because it also seemed to me that Jimmy Stewart, one of his great performances, I think, holding together a movie that you are so aware of the technicalities of the show. So,
and yet he doesn't show up until after the first act.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. He's the latecomer, isn't he?
So, here's one of the things that they do that is incredible, though. There is this, the camera moves in to a position where after dinner is over, the maid or the housekeeper starts bringing the books, the leftover books that have to be put back into that trunk that were taken out to show to one of the guests who's a collector. And he didn't want all the books. Some of the books need to be put back in the trunk. And she starts bringing them in and piling them up next to the trunk. And she's about to open the trunk. And so there's this master shot as you see her getting closer and closer and closer to doing it. And standing just a few feet away, apparently the people who perpetrated the murder don't notice her doing this. And what's great about it is as much as we hate them, we're rooting against her. We don't want them to be found out. And this is one of the most sadistic tricks that Hitchcock ever pulled off. Because it's not a case where we don't want them to be found out because we've learned to love the villains. No, with each passing moment, we learn to hate the villains more and more and more and more.
But it's
proof of how damn fun the movie is. And we don't want the movie to end.
You know, that's probably the truest thing there. Because when it is over in 83 minutes, it feels like it was not rushed, but that, oh my God, that went at breakneck speed. Even though it's a very mannered party. It's not a wild, raucous, Great Gatsby kind of party. So... yeah, I agree. I don't want it to end.
You know, it's really interesting because it almost is aside from the Hitchcock milieu, and it is more what we would later call a high-end art house movie. And I've been promising that we would have this discussion about how high-end art house movies have changed in the 25 years since Tarantino's Pulp Fiction debuted at Cannes, beating Christoph Kieslowski's Trois Couleurs Rouge, the third of his Three Colors trilogy. And we will have that discussion, and I think it's best to do it next week because we'll just be a week away from the opening of Tarantino's new movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But I want to close off by talking about the recent movies from two directors whose previous films were certainly among the best horror films of the decade, but quite frankly, among the best films of the decade, period. And that is Jordan Peele and David Cameron Mitchell. Jordan Peele, of course, directed Get Out. And he has followed that up with a horror movie called Us.
Right.
David Cameron Mitchell, directed the spectacular It Follows. I think I'm getting his name right. I swear to God, I hope I'm getting his name right.
It Follows, filmed here in my town of Detroit.
Yes. His follow-up to It Follows is called Under the Silver Lake. I'm sorry, David Robert Mitchell. Sorry, not David Cameron Mitchell. David Robert Mitchell.
I know, David Cameron Mitchell, I think, is a country singer or something.
But his follow-up is a kind of a modern-day noirish pastiche called Under the Silver Lake. And it's set in Silver Lake, though it's also set in Los Feliz, largely in Los Feliz. And it, right off the bat, starts doing what I so hate L.A. movies doing, which is, okay, good for you. You know all the hip places to film, many of the places I want to film, but you're also lying about the geography, left, right, and center. And I just, you know, and it's, there's that great documentary, L.A. Plays Itself, and it's all about how the psychological damage that was inflicted upon this city because of what the movies did to it in terms of lying about the architecture and the geography. Yeah.
Yeah.
What a study in contrast, because I think these are two really not only great films, but I thought Get Out and It Follows were two really important films. Films that were really about so much stuff, as well as being really scary and really funny and really innovative. And one of them followed up with a movie that is even more a controlled expression of a worldview. And that is Jordan Peele with Us. This is not a movie that's as enjoyable as Get Out, but it is a movie that is more resonant, more deeply resonant.
Right.
Taken with Get Out as companion pieces, the themes that are deepened in Us and explored in Us, taking it away from a racial milieu, at least exclusively a racial milieu, and writing it across America large. It is a movie that says so much about privilege and the cost of privilege, while at the same time still being funny, but rather than being a genre hybrid, is out and out a horror film.
This is what I hear. And what I'm seeing also is a new set of still photographs taken from the movie that are now almost iconographic of where horror is today. Stills, you know, close-ups of reaction shots to the horror. And, you know, very few filmmakers take the liberty to have the camera linger on an actor's face anymore.
Well, and actors, my God, you know, Dean, we've talked about how often comedic actors don't get the credit due to them. What about horror? My God,
yeah.
Right? I guess there have been, you know, Hopkins, I guess you could say, won an Oscar for the horror film Silence of the Lambs, if you want to call it a horror film. And there have been actresses, obviously, that have been acclaimed for their work in horror films. But I think Lupita Nyong'o's performance in a dual role in Us is really, as much as I hate this term, a game changer. If she does not get an Oscar nomination, there is no justice in the world. I would be hard pressed to find four other performances equal to it this decade. It is that good. And this Lupita Nyong'o, by the way, you know, she starts as a production assistant, and I know that she's, I think it's a fine artist of some kind, you know, and it's before she goes to the Yale School of Drama that she studies acting. Her first professional role was in 12 Years a Slave. That's her first professional role, which wins her an Oscar. And so she's so new to this game. And is so good and embodies every choice she makes so completely. Nobody plays fear the way that she does, plays rage the way that she does. She really, it's a masterclass on using your body as an instrument, is what I'm saying. And I can't wait to get to continue to witness what roles Lupita Nyong'o, what performances she's going to give us as this young lady continues her career.
So exciting. Cannot wait.
So the far end of the spectrum from that, one of I would say the worst films of the decade is Under the Silver Lake. David Robert Mitchell's follow-up to this movie is so in his head, full of ideas that he wanted to make.
That's not always a bad film, though.
But it's how would I best put it? It's stillborn. I mean, it's utterly lifeless. Andrew Garfield as an actor who embodies nothing. And absent that, it's just a film of ideas. And a film that's very satisfied with itself. It's a huge disappointment because honestly, the movie is kind of made for Phil Lernis to like.
What?
And if Phil Lernis doesn't like it,
then well, who's your audience?
Yeah, I think it's headache inducing for.
And that's pre-surgery or post-surgery?
Both, I think. Actually, I think I tried it both pre and post. Honestly, but just one of the huge disappointments to me.
Well, sophomore films we know are tough.
Yeah, and then it turns out it's not his sophomore film. It turns out he had made a film prior to It Follows. So there was something about getting out of L.A. and building a world, a unique world, and telling an original story, a visceral story. And think of all those choices and every choice made in this is the opposite. I'm going back to the neighborhood where I was a struggling screenwriter. Yeah. And I'm going to tell stories about that and ideas that came to me based on the movies that I loved.
Right.
And that lovingly winks at worlds and movies that you've loved before.
Oh.
That breath of fresh air that was It Follows. I mean, it is a follow-up that, I'm not going to lie, almost diminishes the film that came before it.
Oh, my God. That is windsucking right there.
Yeah, and I would say it's been since The Brothers Bloom that a follow-up to a film that I loved has quite done that to me. When Rian Johnson made The Brothers Bloom after Brick. And, you know, and here's the thing. Brick was perfect. Brick was the movie that this guy wants to be making. And Brick was a financial failure. Even at a low budget, that was a financial failure. And that was great. I mean, we do live in a time where if you make a neo-noir and it's fantastic, it's going to lose money. But at best, will become a cult favorite. This lost money and is a cult failure. But Rian Johnson's Brothers Bloom was very much weak for the same ways. It was all about, oh, now I have carte blanche to show you all my ideas instead of to tell a story.
Right. If there's anything we can impart to the kids, and by kids, I mean filmmakers who come before us, it is have a second movie in mind when that first one hits so that you're not left scrambling.
Well, you know, I mentioned Robert Altman earlier, and I finally saw for the first time his movie Brewster McCloud that came out the same year as MASH. It came out at the end of the year of MASH, and it holds up very well. It's really strikingly funny and rich. Not for everyone's taste. I mean, it's you have to work kind of hard as an audience member, but. But why I bring it up is it's his favorite. It's Altman's favorite of all the movies he ever made.
Really?
And you can tell because he didn't write it, but he is bringing so much energy and passion to it as a director. He loves the movie he's making. And what I always think of about Altman, and it's one of the reasons he's my favorite probably director, though there are other directors like Kubrick who are close, but whose movies I like more than I like Altman's. The thing about Altman that was so refreshing was he always thought, rather than different movies, that he was writing one book, and each movie was its own chapter. And that's how he thought of it. And so the approach you know, is still interesting, even during the failures, to me anyway. You know, and that's where I'm saying is, you know, have another movie that you want to tell. But it's really refreshing with Jordan Peele that what he's exploring and developing is his ability to put a fascinating worldview on display on screen. And this film, his second film, doubles down, expands upon, and deepens the socio cultural, political, economic themes that the first film introduced.
Which is what horror should always explore. Horror should also always be an exploration of the sociological phenomena, the whatever issues in terms of race prejudice, whatever society is going through. You can have that be a metaphor in horror every time. You just have to have the creative ability. I mean, there's only so many ways to kill and be killed. So those tropes of murder and torture and whatever, but manifest itself in what we are as a country experiencing, seems to be a ready well to go back to for the brave and the talented.
You know, the other thing about Under the Silver Lake that is so disappointing for me is here's a film that wants to be about, in some ways, a culture of consumption and misogyny, especially the consumption of women and the consumption of dreams. And yet, the film is guilty of the very things it's trying to expose.
You know, wait a second. That, this sounds like a lady killer's argument.
Yeah, you know, the fine line, the real challenge that we faced, which is we got to make sure that if we're making a movie about exploitation, that it does not become exploitative, right? And I quite disappointed, again, that, you know, it fails in that regard. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of another action-packed installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. You can find so many of the episodes at chillpackhollywood.com. You can find all of them at Blog Talk Radio. People can write us, can't they, Dean?
They sure can. The chillpackhollywood at yahoo.com. And if we enjoy your email, if we find it interesting, we'll read it on the air and address it.
ChillPackHollywood@yahoo.com. Finally, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at both places. What's our handle, Dean?
Our handle is at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and for both the Twitter and the Instagram.
And finally, if you're not too busy storming Area 51, why don't you storm our Facebook page, facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood. Until next week, I'm Phil Larinus.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.